Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's lovely to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me, Fran and the other people involved in organising this day. I want to say, first of all, that I think it's brilliant this day has happened. I hope it will be repeated and will grow and expand. I think there's a real gap there in the Cambridge market, if you like. I think it's just a fantastic concept. I was very pleased to be asked to come, but I do have to issue a disclaimer. Probably the first speaker today who doesn't have a PhD and has never studied for one, doesn't even have a proper master's degree in terms of research. So I'm very much in awe of all of you who are either working on those things or have them already. I suppose what I do have, though, is 15 years working in central Cambridge pastorally, and the experience of seeing generation after generation of people go through master's and PhD programmes, and having the privilege of talking to some of them about that, and just being aware of some of the issues that it raises for you. So it's a privilege to be able to come at one particular angle on academic research today, which is that of idolatry. Now, I suppose the person in the street, if you mentioned an idol to them, would think of two things: either one of those wonderful Greek statues in the Fitzwilliam Museum, which students in classical studies or other fields might be doing their PhDs on, or the way it's used, as in a pop idol or a sporting idol or something like that. And the idea of an idol in academia would seem really very remote. And maybe it's an unfamiliar approach to you. I think it's a very fruitful way of thinking about the whole of our lives and the way that our hearts operate with what's out there in the rest of life. And I think it's a very biblical one as well. So, yes, here we are. I found it very interesting that when John was writing his first letter, he writes at some length about all sorts of problems that Christians are facing. Problems with the doctrine of Christ, for example. They really believe that Jesus has come in the flesh. Other kinds of sin. Speaking in unhelpful ways with other Christians, not sharing goods with other Christians, just all manner of different aspects of the Christian life, much of which seems quite familiar to us today. And the way he signs off his letter is by saying, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." And what's interesting about it is there has been no previous mention explicitly of first century literal idolatry at any point in the letter. It's one of the reasons why it does seem quite contemporary. There's nothing about pagan temples, there's nothing about graven images, there's nothing about meat or sacrifices or anything like that in that way in the letter. But he signs himself off by saying, "Dear children, keep yourself from idols." Scholarly opinion divides a little bit on whether he's just having an afterthought and realising that after all they needed to be told not to go to the temples and worship the Greek idols. And he sort of had to put it in the last minute as a kind of coda to the letter. But I think majority and more wise opinion would see that as a kind of way of summarising everything else that had happened in the letter. That without using the language of metaphorical idolatry, he actually is seeing the whole of it through that lens and inviting his readers to go back over the letter and to interpret it all that way. And that would certainly be my reading of it, based on the prevalence of idolatry as an issue in Scripture and of the fruitfulness of seeing it as a metaphorical issue, not simply as a literal one. If it's a literal one, then all I need to tell you is if you're studying ancient Greek statues, don't go and worship them, and this is kind of end of discussion. But actually, I think there's much more that can help us there. And I presented you something which I've personally found very fruitful. And I think a number of other people have found that it has huge explanatory power for what's going on in their lives. When they start to understand some of their hopes and fears, some of their disappointments, some of their drives, some of the decisions they make in terms of idolatry. Well, I want to get you to do some work, and we need to start trying to define what an idol is then. And I'd like you to split into groups, and you can decide what sort of groups you want to be. It might be a pair, might be three, might be four. And just try to produce a definition of what an idol is using these verses in particular. This is from the Ten Commandments. "You shall have no other gods before or besides me," depending on whether you take the footnote in the new NIV. And then Colossians 3:5, "Put to death whatever belongs to your earthly nature." And then he has a long list, which I haven't given you. The last item in the list is greed, which is idolatry. I'd like you to try to come up with the definition of what an idol is from those verses. Okay, got 3 or 4 minutes to do that. Good. Let's hear from you then. Let's hear some definitions of what an idol is. Don't be shy. Just going to start. Thank you.
Something that is overvalued.
Something is overvalued. Do you want to expand that?
So, at least we're sort of having a little debate, but I sort of feel that something can be an idol even if you don't consider it to be more important than God, but if it has some sort of value in God's eyes, or and you consider it to be more important than God would wish for you to consider, then it would be overvalued.
Yeah, that's a subtle definition, it's helpful. Thank you. Anyone else? Let's hear from someone. Yeah, great.
Also, a distortion of purpose.
Distortion of purpose.
For what something is supposed to be used for.
Yeah, yeah. And those two, not so far from each other. One's using the language of value. You're more sort of Aristotelian, talking about telos or purpose. But you know, the two are kind of two sides of the same coin. Very good. Yeah, John.
Anything that is ascribed the worth that finally belongs to God or becomes the object of our affections in place of God.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And here we're getting into issues of displacing God from his rightful place, or ascribing something to an idol that should be ascribed to God. Again, that's very biblical. Anything to add, anything? Any more? Let's have some more ideas. You were buzzing away when you were in buzz groups. Let's hear from you now. Other thoughts? Okay. Yeah, Elspeth.
Are you thinking about how interesting it is that Paul describes greed as idolatry?
Yeah.
I suppose we were more using the language of what's the master of you and what you're slave to, and how what you're greedy for is what you desire, what absolutely influences all the sort of decisions you take in life. And so anything that has that power over you is like
a desire which becomes too big, and so therefore gains a kind of power over you. Inordinate desire. These things all kind of fit together. Now, they're slightly different, but they're different angles on one thing. Okay. Who want to add anything? Yeah, Jonathan.
Initially don't start
out as idols, but things like an academic career, not necessarily an idol,
become one
of
it, control
and
goal,
or something around which all our desires, aspirations, hopes are centred instead of God. Yeah. Okay. I think that's a very important observation. Almost all idols have their own right value, their own right purpose, their own place in God's creation, but we give them inordinate value, we desire them too much, we give them the wrong sense of purpose, and so on. Very good. Anyone else want to take us any further? Okay. Well, let's look at some more scriptures. How do idols work? This is a lovely passage from Jeremiah. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it before. I'm not even sure I preached it when I preached to Jeremiah. It'd be lovely to look at the whole thing, because it's very powerful. He imagines people coming to the Jewish nation and saying this: to you the nations will come from the ends of the earth and say, our fathers possessed nothing but false gods, worthless idols that did them no good. Do people make their own gods? Yes, but they are not gods. There's a lot we could look at in there, but I suppose I was particularly interested in the first bit of verse 20. Do people make their own gods? And the answer, yes. Idols are things that we create. We generate them. Our hearts and our cultures generate the idols. In the Old Testament, there are repeated descriptions of people manufacturing idols. You may know some of them from Isaiah, where, with great sarcasm, but also a certain literary craft, he describes idol manufacture, which a lot of work went into. And, you know, statues in the Fitzwilliam, the British Museum, and so on, absolutely stunning. I mean, it's kind of humanity's ability, almost at its height, and yet they were being made in order to be worshipped in the place of the true God. If we see idol as metaphor rather than literal, not something you would put in a worship service or a religious cult, but as something that we worship in our hearts and outside of such things, again, we create them. We may in some cases literally manufacture them, but it may not be that. It may be that we take something like a relationship, like a person, but the way we invest in that and the way that we see that relationship, that person, becomes idolatrous. It's important to realise that our hearts are what Calvin calls idol factories. Some of Calvin's great phrases. There's some dispute over the exact translation of it, but I'm pretty sure he meant to say that our hearts are idol factories. We are wired because of the fall and original sin and our depravity. We are wired to create idols. We should expect to find idols in our lives because that is the way we are wired. That's the default position. How do they work? What they do is that an idol allures us and disappoints us. That's putting perhaps a little bit more of an active role there for the idol than is completely fair, because in fact it's we who allow ourselves to be allured. I suppose the missing part of that equation is the role of Satan and evil satanic forces who make things seem alluring, and we need to understand that and to assume it. This is one of my other favourite bits of Jeremiah. My people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. My people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. This is psychologically extremely penetrating, I think, and it's full of explanatory power. First of all, notice the language of exchange, and that's there in the grammar of that commandment from the Ten Commandments. No God besides me or before me or instead of me. Well, this is the language of exchange. A glorious God. A God who is himself inherently glorious and who invites us to join in his glory as his saved children. Exchange that for something which is inherently worthless when seen this way. Empty. And there's a contrast in that verse, I think, between the weightiness of God, the glory is associated with, and the emptiness and the vanity of the idol. But the exchange happens because they exert this kind of allure on our hearts. Jeremiah speaks of it in terms of a double sin. My people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, the spring of living water. And this is where the metaphor is very powerful. It pictures a spring of living water, which for a Middle Eastern village is obviously the key to life. It's not water being piped in from reservoirs miles away. You have a spring, you get your water from there, or you die. A spring of living water is a very, very precious thing. And instead have dug their own cisterns. So we think of cisterns in terms of toilets. That's not what they what the word means. It's like a kind of pear-shaped underground storage place. And it was used as an alternative or a supplement to a spring. The problem was they tended to get a bit yucky. I managed to dig up a report of a traveller in the 19th century who'd been in Palestine and seen one of these springs, and he said it was disgusting water. It was full of those kind of wiggly things, you know, that you get in puddles and so on. That I think, is a kind of cistern that's doing well. A broken cistern is still worse. The water would go down into it, but it wouldn't be able to hold it properly. But somehow the idol has exerted some sort of power in distorting the people's view of what it was, that it seemed to offer something that only God could offer. It was taking God's place in their understanding, in their vision of their lives, in terms of what it could offer. God was offering water, the idol was offering water. And the lie and the internal deception is that we think an idol will give us something we can only get from God himself. And what idols do? This is a great passage in Psalm 135. The idols of the nation, silver and gold, made by human hands. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but cannot see. They have ears but cannot hear, nor is there breath in their mouths. It's obviously the description of a literal idol, which is just a statue and has no animation to it at all. But the interesting reflection is something you find quite a lot in Scripture, verse 18. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. There's a great book by a guy, a theologian called Greg Beale, called We Become What We Worship. We Become What We Worship. The book itself is actually quite hard going, and you can kind of get most of the benefit from just memorising the title, actually, unless you're a professional, in which case you'll enjoy all that. But he's summing up this biblical theme, we become what we worship. Now think of that for a moment. As we worship Jesus Christ, we are transformed and we become more like Jesus. As we worship anything else, we become like it. Now that could mean a whole range of different things. And I think the vision here is of people worshipping idols and their humanity being degraded by that act. Idols have a dehumanising effect. We become lesser people. That's to put it in a very general way, but I believe that is what happens. Our humanity is degraded. I remember talking to someone who, he'd done a PhD in physics, I think, and then gave it up in the end. And I'm not saying it's why anyone else should give it up, but he'd done it, but it was in a postgraduate program, I think. And he just found that his ability to have human relationships had been degraded by the way he'd done his PhD and his postdoc thing. I'm not saying that necessarily happens, but there was something about the way he had approached it that had been idolatrous, and he just found his capacity for loving relationships and being part of the community shrinking. And that's one of the more graphic things that I became aware of in dealing with people. So, those are some of the ways that idols work. Does anyone want to make any comments on that? Is anything immediately striking a chord, or do you want to add something or correct me in some way? Anything you feel could be brought out a bit better, a bit more fully? Or just ask a question? Okay. Well, let's move on. I hope that as we've been working on this material so far, your minds will be whirring away and you'll have started to make some connections and some identifications. Typically, people do that reasonably quickly once the kind of idea of an idol is set out like that and the Holy Spirit starts working in their hearts and they start to see, yes, I can see how this could be an idol in my life. But one doesn't always get it. And it can, I think, be very useful to have some awareness of how to do self-diagnosis for idolatry. And to do that, we need to ask diagnostic questions. Now, on your handouts, there's two or three there I've put down. And then I looked at some material that a friend of mine sent me, and I thought we could expand what's down there a little bit. So I've got a few more up here. Here we are. There's quite a lot of them. So let me just read it through. And what you'll be aware of, these are looking at the same thing in slightly different ways, and it just may be that one of the questions helps you more than another. Let me just read them through. What is my greatest nightmare? What do I worry about most? What if I failed or lost it would cause me to feel that I did not even want to live? What keeps me going? What do I rely on to comfort self with? Some misspelling there. When things go bad or get difficult. What do I think most easily about? What does my mind go to when I'm free? What preoccupies me? What prayer unanswered would make me seriously think about turning away from God? What makes me feel the most self-worth? What am I the proudest of? What do I really want and expect out of life? What would really make me happy? can probably see what's going on there. It's trying to probe us at quite a deep level of motivation and desire, because idolatry is almost always connected with those things. Idols exert this allure and power. They seem to offer things which are God's substitutes in terms of gifts. And the way they connect with us in terms of the structure of the human psyche and our motivation is along these sorts of lines. Different sorts of personality will respond to different sorts of questions in different ways. That's partly why I put so many down there. These are the sorts of questions that start to unpack where it is that the idols lie in our hearts. Now, there's another wrinkle to this that I've also found quite helpful that I want to add, and we can have a little discussion, and then I want to get you thinking about academia. I found this distinction quite helpful. Like quite a lot of the stuff I've done on idolatry, I think this ultimately originally came from Tim Keller, but it was mediated to me through a couple of friends in the United States, so it doesn't directly come from him. It's the distinction between a surface idol and a deep idol. A surface idol and a deep idol. Let me explain what I mean by that. I do think that idolatry does operate on these different levels, and you can have something which is what you focused on, and that is an idol, but actually deep down, there is another kind of idol, but you have to have something that thing will give you. So I've just put some things here. Typically, they're not ones to do with academia, and I've done that deliberately because I want you to do the work on this later. So, an expensive car, it could be an idol. Not necessarily, but it could be. Perfect garden could easily be an idol. For many people, new clothes are idolatrous, though not for everybody. Church attendance can quite easily be one of the most pernicious kinds of religious idol. Exotic summer holidays. Tidy home with a smiling wife is its own particular kind of idol, and I'll try and explain where that comes from later. Climbing up a career ladder. Having a boyfriend or having well-behaved kids. It's all fairly domestic, isn't it? Well, they would be the surface things. They're the actual things which are good in and of themselves. But for some people they would be idols, for some people they wouldn't, because for some people would invest an expectation and a hope in, I don't know, having a perfect garden, for example, that someone else wouldn't. Someone might be very disappointed if they didn't have a perfect garden. Someone else would just shrug it off and say, oh, I'm not bothered about it this year, and in fact, not in any other year either. That tends to be because there is a deep idol lurking underneath that people have invested their hope in, or a deep goal. Very often this is idolatrous, though. So these are my sort of suggestions as to what some of these things could be. And you'll notice that this is a much more generic list, and there aren't actually that many things on it. And it may be a slightly simplistic summary of human goals, but I think it's quite workable. Why would someone want an expensive car? Well, they might want it just because they were someone who's absolutely addicted to comfort. I saw a Rolls-Royce get past me on the A14 this morning as I was coming up from Fendrayton. Maybe they bought it for a good reason. Maybe it's someone who just had to travel in that kind of luxury. But for many people, it's to do with their public reputation, and approval is a very big deal. This is a very male thing, I think. Perfect garden. For some people, it's about control. And life just does not feel livable if the domestic environment isn't deeply under control. And a perfect garden is an expression of that, and they're actually very, very edgy without it. And then that has all sorts of knock-on effects for other people. I suppose it could be an element of aesthetic comfort about it as well, I don't know. That could be approval as well. For me, the issue with gardening is parental approval. Because I know when my mother comes to say she's going to walk around and I'm going to feel lousy if the garden isn't looking good. This is my little gardening idol. It's one of the few, almost the only thing that I'm relieved about my father having died, that he can't look around it anymore and disapprove of my garden not being able to scratch. Not that he was ever like that. New clothes can easily be to do with approval. Could be to do with comfort, but probably approval. Church attendance, approval. The knowledge that the church staff have seen you in and seen you out for two more services on a Sunday, I mean, it makes you feel good for the rest of the week. Well, maybe it doesn't, but some people weren't like that. And security as well. Religious idols operate in this way. they exert a kind of allure for us that if we do certain things and we maintain them, we are secure religiously. Exotic summer holidays could be comfort, could be approval, probably more comfort than approval for some people, it's keeping up with the others. Tidy home, smiling wife, it's about control, life being under control. I mean, it could be the other way around, it could be tidy home, smiling husband, roles reversed. I think very often this is a control thing. I want life just to be controlled with an element of comfort there too. Climbing up a career ladder, power, and actually got power in many others, so power could be here as well, I suppose. And again, control, very often. But you could have approval there too. Boyfriend, security, comfort, either of those things. Well-behaved kids. So often parents just can't relax, and I put myself, my parenting in this category, just can't relax and allow children to be children because they want the control, but they also want the reputation, they want the approval to be there, but often it's just an element of control that is going on. Now, there are all sorts of ways of configuring this and different ways of understanding it, but what I found helpful in this kind of approach, which I got from this friend called Jenny Dulcey, is to try to understand for myself what are the underlying drives towards that are to do with phones, watches, sporting interests, what we buy for the house, where we go on holiday, any of those things. If I'm realising that they're starting to get a bit kind of out of proportion, suspecting they're mimicking God in my heart, I'll just offer you that as something which I think can be very fruitful, as I've seen myself. But to come back to your sheet, I'll try to summarise this in terms of some take home. Look at those two fill in the blanks questions there, or sentences there. Life only has meaning if. Why do I feel so deeply about this? The life only has meaning if question is putting ourselves under our own microscope and asking quite a searching question. So why do I feel so deeply about question is more response to situations. And I offer it as one that can be very helpful. You go to a supervision and your supervisor is unimpressed with what you've done. And you get a very, very strong reaction to that. Is there an idol lurking? Now, it's quite natural to be a bit disappointed. Of course, anybody would be, and you have to be made of stainless steel, not, of course, and we understand that. But a very, very strong reaction. Same with disappointment in a relationship, for example, or something else not working out. People who become enraged, when a bus goes a minute early, or, you know, there's a whole range of different aspects of life where we have very strong negative reactions that are quite out of proportion to the situation. I think that is one of the best diagnostic tests for an idol.